Thanks, Carl, and thanks everyone for welcoming me so generously into your Sangha and your space tonight. I really feel very honored to and delighted to be with you tonight. So thank you. One of the practices that I've been really enjoying lately is a new practice for me from Lama Rod Owens. Some of you may know him as a Black, queer, Southern, fat Dharma teacher from Tibetan lineages. And he wrote a new book recently called Love and Rage. If you haven't had a chance to check it out yet, it's worth reading. And one of his practices that he returns to again and again there is called the Seven Homecomings. And he builds on this practice that we have in Buddhism called taking refuge. And traditionally we call in the support of these three jewels, the Buddha, our teacher and guide, the Dharma, the wisdom or truth, and the Sangha, this community of practice that we find support in. And so that's only three. And in Lama Rod's practice, there's seven. So what else is here? So in his practice, he invites in four additional sources of support. And he talks about it as also weaving in some indigenous practices from outside of Buddhism. But as I think about it, it also feels like many of these were likely obvious supports during the time and cultural context of the Buddha. And many of them feel like they've, you know, especially for those of us who are raised in cultural contexts that are hyper individualized, it's really important to reconnect with these. So what are they? He invites us to call in connection to ancestors and lineage, connection with the earth, this connection with silence and space, and connection with ourselves. And to really weave all of these seven parts together as we lean into a capacity to practice, not by ourselves, but actually in a rich fabric of community. So I really have appreciated that as a practice, particularly in COVID times, where it can feel easy to feel alone, to remember that there is actually a vast network consistently and constantly here with us. So as part of that, I wanted to dive in a little bit deeper on one of those jewels, one of those homecomings, one of those points of refuge. And that's the second one, which is taking refuge in Dharma, taking refuge in truth, in wisdom. What are we talking about when we talk about that? And part of this, I'm actually teaching tomorrow night as well with the Alphabet Sangha at East Bay Meditation Center with my friend Patrick Brown. So if you want to hear more about this, come visit us there. So I'm sure we'll get into some other juicy contexts. But it was interesting because we talked about discussing this topic a few weeks ago. And it now feels especially poignant as our national political conditions just changed. We had an inauguration last week. And so talking about truth and taking refuge in truth feels especially important. I know I had really minimized my own memory of just how distorted truth had felt. And it wasn't until I watched the new administration hold their first formal press conference on Inauguration Day last Wednesday, where I was like, oh, right, my experience of truth telling feels different now that contexts are changing. and the new press secretary, Jen Psaki, it was important to her to begin her remarks by talking about truth. And she said, when the president asked me to serve in this role, we talked about the importance of bringing truth and transparency back to the briefing room. And he asked me to ensure we are communicating about the policies across the administration and the work his team is doing every single day on behalf of all American people. And there might be times we see things differently in this room, I mean, among all of us, and that's okay because that's part of democracy. And rebuilding trust with the American people will be central to our focus in the press office and in the White House every single day. So this is a certain kind of truth that Jen Psaki as press secretary is talking about. This kind of truth that's about getting to the facts, supporting things with research, being as in accordance with reality as possible. And this gives us some guidepost to what the Buddha is talking about when he talks about Dharma or truth as something we might take refuge in. So a big thing I think about when I think about Dharma as truth is that we're really being invited to take refuge in the way things really are. And what does that mean? How do we actually find out how things really are? So I often think about the two pathways. There's maybe more than two, but two main pathways where we can get some direct information about truth and reality. So one way we use this word Dharma in a lot of contexts. So one way we use it is to specifically describe the wisdom texts that have been passed down for 2,600 years since the time of the Buddha that share his insights about what is real, what is reality like. And I'll share a little bit more with you about that tonight. But the second way to find out about how things really are is that we explore it through our experience. And I appreciated this quote from Vietnamese teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who says, you know, the Dharma books and tapes are valuable, but true Dharma is revealed through our life and our practice. So I invite you, as I share thoughts from the Buddha with you tonight, how do you take that in a receptive mode of practice? Even as we're sharing Dharma, it's still in a practice mode. Whatever words I share, how do they land in your own embodied experience? And I think that's especially important for me as a queer person who experienced some pretty significant spiritual wounding from Christianity growing up. It can be really hard for me to just like sit in a teaching seat and try to tell you that Buddhism is true and expect that you should just believe me. I mean, a little about my own wounding. I actually had a pretty deep love of Christianity and the kind of community that it could offer me, especially in my teenage years. And that's mostly thanks to one really great pastor and who could really create a kind of safety that my parents did not know how to create for me as a child. So when I went off to college, I expected all churches to feel that welcoming. Not true. So I tried out a bunch of different churches and youth groups and landed at the one that sang the best songs. And also it happened to be the one that was right next to my dorm. So that was highly convenient on Sunday mornings. So I did not have to walk very far. I was just getting to know the church community, and they put a sign out up front that they were starting a workshop where they were going to start healing the sins of gay people. Ouch. Right? I saw you, Lynn. Right? Wow. Now, to be clear, like me at 18, I was so incredibly disembodied from growing up in a family filled with secrecy and lies and trauma. I wasn't actually even out to myself, much less to the world. But like, if we would have had a gay straight alliance when I was a kid in high school, I would have been the president. Like, I was like gung ho about passionately believing that gay and lesbian folks were not sinners, not people who needed to be healed or changed. And so I was just enraged and upset, like unable to sleep for a whole week, feeling abhorrent that I had spent even 1 minute of time enjoying a church that believed such things. Like, it was just so horrible to me. So I spent that whole week lost in shame, and I never went back to that church again, and actually never went back to church again. Like, it just was done with church, because I could not trust the reliability of what this tradition was trying to teach me when it was so obviously steeped in oppression. So when I was first started to dip my toes back into any kind of spiritual practice and wisdom through meditation and Buddhism, one of the things that really held me and cared for me in that process was the Buddha's deep invitation to not just believe in things because he said so, but to try things on for myself. In the language where his words were first written down, this is called ehipasiko, this idea that you can see for yourself as the greatest tool for developing spiritual insight. He talks about this in the Kalama Sutra when he was visiting the Kalama people. This is what he said. Do not believe in something because it is reported. Do not believe in something because it has been practiced by generations or becomes a tradition or part of a culture. Do not believe in something because a scripture says it is so. Do not believe in something believing a God has inspired it. Do not believe in something a teacher tells you to. Do not believe in something because the authorities say it is so. Do not believe in hearsay, rumor, speculative opinion, public opinion, or mere acceptance to logic and inference alone. Help yourself accept as completely true only that which is praised by the wise and which you test for yourself and know to be good for yourself and others. So this gives you a sense of how we structure our time together, that there's a real priority in our own practice, really cultivating our capacity to listen and explore our own experience. And to have that coupled with teachers or experienced practitioners pointing to what might be worth checking out for yourself as you continue to develop your own practice. In this way, I think about finding refuge in truth. It's less about putting all our faith in the wisdom of any guru, or in the political realm, putting all our faith in the wisdom of new presidents. The work we're doing is really about cultivating our own sense of wisdom and integrity, and actually learning to trust that sense of wisdom. For me, rebuilding this kind of self-trust has actually been one of the most important antidotes to shame, which undergirds so much of suffering in this life. So what is it that I would point to as reality that we can take refuge in? Something that you can check out for yourself and see if it's true. So there's a lot that the Buddha shares as truth, a lot of wisdom. But one thing the Buddha invites us into, a very fundamental reframe about how we see the world and how we see ourselves in it. And in changing our perspective, it can really change how we imagine we can ask for and give support. So I think a lot about these three fundamental truths about reality, often called the three characteristics of existence in the Buddha's language. And for me, when I am able to see these three truths more clearly, it helps and it can abandon some old ways of thinking. It really can transform how I show up in the world. So what are those three truths, those three characteristics? So one, everyone suffers. There's no magic status as a rich celebrity, hetero white dude where suddenly all your troubles are gone. Now it's true that our material privileges and basic safety under white supremacy and heteropatriarchy are very different. Like that's true. And yet despite every effort to kind of accumulate utter bliss through privilege, everybody still suffers. It's just part of the human condition. So that's number one, everybody suffers. Two, everyone is connected. When you are suffering, you are not some individual being who's alone in that suffering. Your experience emerges from a vast set of causes and conditions. And in some small or large way, I can actually connect and see how I am complicit in your suffering and could actually be equally complicit in your liberation from that suffering. But that's always possible. And this third understanding of reality is that everything is constantly changing. If you're suffering this moment, I'm suffering the next moment. It's like this constant cycle. It's, you know, it's moving, it's changing. So everyone suffers, everyone is connected, everything is constantly changing. So what do these truths about reality look like in real life? How do we see them? So I'm part of a transformative justice study group that's made up of a bunch of queer folks, mostly Dharma people. If you don't know transformative justice, it's a body of study and work that's really trying to change how we can get out of mindsets that require us to rely on policing, prisons, and punishment when harm is caused in the world. Like what else is possible? How else can we hold each other accountable that might be more caring, loving, and community-based? So a group of friends were curious about how to learn about this. So it's a mixed race, mixed gender group. And last week we started trying out a mutual aid practice where everyone who wanted to identified things where if they were able to offer things, they put it on the spreadsheet. And if there were things that they needed, they put it on the spreadsheet. Asking for help, offering help, seeing what could match. So how does this play out in these, in reality? So it's true here, as we laid out the spreadsheet, that everyone suffers. There wasn't anybody in our group that was like, I can help a bunch, but there's nothing I need help with. Everyone had something they needed help with. Some people listed things like food, not just for themselves, but also for roommates who had extra heavy workloads right now, grocery shopping, emotional check-ins, help figuring out how to set boundaries, taking sunset walks together, socially distanced, of course. I know for me, it was a practice though, just to list the things I needed help with. In the individualist capitalist culture that I feel very steeped in, I can really take on the belief that I'm responsible for taking care of all of my needs by myself. And it adds the second arrow of suffering where I'm already suffering because my need is unmet. And I believe that I have to take care of it by myself and can't actually ask for help. So it was deeply healing just to even identify is possible to name this and see that others could too. So everyone is connected. It was actually really beautiful to watch folks fill out the spreadsheet and see it evolve into an interconnected community of support. Some people needed to be fed and other people wanted to offer food. Somebody needed help with dog sitting and another person wanted to watch dogs. Somebody needed help with an outdoor building project and a couple other people wanted to offer help with manual labor and building skills. The connection emerged. I'm also feeling how everything is constantly changing. As part of the project, a friend reached out to talk logistics on a project that I needed help with. And halfway through the conversation, we switched to supporting them about getting more accountable about getting gender pronouns right. So by the end of the conversation, it was clear we were both helpers and we were both receiving help. It was just a mix of finding the support that we all needed. And I know as LGBTQ folks in this group, I felt like there was something particularly healing in repairing this cycle of reciprocity, of giving and receiving help. Whether we have experienced this ache of being banished from families or communities of origin, or if we've just internalized this sense of hyper-individualism because of our efforts to resist or avoid queer and transphobia, finding these small and large opportunities to repair this cycle of reciprocity felt like it can deeply repair this particular kind of wounding where we can actually be in community. So I offer these reflections on taking Dharma, taking refuge in Dharma, taking refuge in truth, again, as a real invitation to take refuge in your own practice in relation to the wisdom offered by the Buddha. To really explore these reframes that the Buddha offers about how to see and experience the world. And to find out, when you explore this in your own practice, what happens? What do you learn? And I hope as you do, you can find some greater ease, healing, protection, care, happiness, anything else you might need as you look and care for yourself. So thank you for your attention and your practice tonight.
Dawn, thank you. Thank you so much for that beautiful Dharma talk.